okay? Good or just okay? So let's begin with. I should finish up Jeffrey's. I was going to say let's begin with some questions, but he had asked a question before, and I said I would talk about it a little bit now. So, once one has become an Arya on the Hinayana path, either Shravaka or Pratyeka Buddha, Pratyeka Buddha path, you know, Shravaka path, Pratyeka Buddha path, one, the classic, very well-known presentation of what are called the four Aryas, four types of Aryas. Actually, you could also say eight. We'll explain why. Four Aryas. What was it? Stream enterer. What's the Sanskrit or the Pali? No, the four stream enterer. What's the Pali name? What is Sotapanna? Something like that. Sotapanna. And then once returner. No, what was it? No more returner? What did it call? Never returner, not returning, not at all. And then arhat. So, Jeffrey had asked a little bit about that before, just to. So, yeah, he knows about it. But I think he was like the Buddha sometimes asking so that the person who's talking will give a more full presentation. He knows already, so he doesn't. He's just asking. So to like when Lama Zopa Rinpoche asks questions of His Holiness or other teachers, you know, it's not because he doesn't know. It's because he knows it'll be beneficial for the audience to hear the answers to this. So what these are referring to is that, and we'll go into more detail in next week when we go into the nitty gritty details of what are abandoned, what are ceased on the various levels of the path of seeing, the path of meditation, and everything. Basically, one becomes a stream enterer once one has become an Arya being. But it only lasts for a certain amount of time until one enters into the next stage. Basically, what it means is that one has eliminated a certain portion of those afflictions that are to be abandoned by the Hinayana path. Okay, so until arhatship, from the path of seeing and the path of meditation, and that period, one is abandoning various afflictions, various what are called objects to be abandoned, things to be abandoned. And so on the according to the Hinayana point of view, on the path of seeing, one gets rid of the first six of nine innate obstructions that are associated with the desire realm. So what does that mean? And next week we'll go into more detail. As you progress along this path of seeing and path of meditation, there are the afflictions that one is successively abandoning, you know, putting up the obstacles to and abandoning, are becoming more and more subtle. So one is abandoning, first of all, the grosser varieties, and then subsequently those that are more subtle. Generally, there are said to be three realms of cyclic existence. Do you know what those are when we say the three realms? The desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm. So what, maybe just get an idea of that, because some of you know what these are, some of you, have you heard of those before? Form realm, formless realm? No, okay, you're good. Test for my, to check whether people know. So generally the realm that we experience now as humans and those things that we generally consider inferior to ourselves, such as the animal realm, the preta realm, you know the pretas, hungry ghosts, and the hell realm, and some portion of those that are a little bit higher than us, some of the god realms, we'll explain, which are said to inhabit the realm of desire, because we're, in a sense, we're dominated by attachment and our desires that impel us to create karma and so forth and so on, the desire realm. There are certain gods, we say devas, that also that are higher than that, that are in the form and formless realms. When we say devas, we mean sentient beings that happen to have a rebirth in one of those realms. Some of the gods are not so far from us in the desire realm. Indra is considered to be the king of the gods on the top of Mount Meru, and there's some of the different levels below that. When the Buddha, there's one famous holiday, we say the descent of Buddha from the heaven of 33, or the descent of Buddha. Sometimes people say the descent from Tushita, which is completely wrong, right? Have you ever heard that, seen that mistake? I know, one of the places I've lived and taught for some time, every time that holiday comes, they say, oh, celebration of the Buddha's descent from Tushita. When did the Buddha descend from Tushita? Did he? When he was coming down to take birth in the womb of his mother and so forth. There's not, that's, but later, at a certain point, his natural mother had passed away and was reborn in one of these desire realm, god realms. Not the former formless realms, in the desire realm, in what's called the heaven of 30, heaven of, thinking out the three, heaven of 33. And he'd gone up during one rainy season, so it was a little bit quiet, it's like someone doing retreat during the rainy season. While the other monks were doing retreat, he went up to the heaven of 33 to teach his mom, thinking of the kindness of the mother. Even the Buddha disturbs his usual schedule to go teach his mother. Do you know what he taught her? Do you know what he taught? Is it? Skiti Garbo Sutra? Oh, I hadn't heard that. Okay. Generally, it said, oh, listen, the common between the Hinayana and Mahayana, because I'm not sure the Hinayana has Skiti Garbo Sutra. Maybe that's exclusive that the Mahayana says he taught. But generally, it says he taught his mother Abhidharma, sort of like sophisticated, sort of like this, like low rig and salam, these courses that we're talking. So, details about mental factors and all this. And then at a certain point, the disciples get on earth in the desire realm, began to get itchy, and they made requests, and the Buddha descended. There's some pictorial representations of a ladder, the Buddha walking down this ladder, a stairway to get down. So he came back to the, he was still in the desire realm. He hadn't left the desire realm, but he was in the god realm. So all of these are called the desire realm, the hell, preta, animal, human, and a certain portion of the god realms. It's not ambiguous, it's the first lowest levels. Then above that, there is a a rebirth state called the form realm, the Rupa Dhatu. So this particular state you can be reborn in, and you will have some kind of subtle body, but your mental consciousness is one which is already devoid of certain of the delusions that are prevalent in the desire realm, mainly anger. You can't get angry in the form realm or the formless realm. There, all of the other delusions are somewhat subdued. They're more subtle. Do you know the cause to be born in the form realm? Someone said? Who said? I heard someone anyone, do you know? Samadhi? Any kind of samadhi? A jhana state, okay. So there's certain kinds of karma that we can create that is virtuous, non-virtuous. Some of it is called immovable karma. Have you ever heard that in the Lanrim? Immovable karma? It means karma that will only be ripen in a particular state. It can't ripen in any other state. Certain actions we do now, if you create generosity as a human or other things, practice morality, patience, that may ripen while you're a human. It might ripen to ameliorate, to lessen your suffering as a hell being or as a preta or as an animal. Say, being generous can be the cause of being born as a wealthy naga, you know, which realm is the naga, are the nagas in? Preta realm? Jeffrey says yes. No, animal realm, right? They're actually considered part of the animal realm. Sometimes they manifest as serpents, so sometimes they to indicate nagas, like Nargajuna, sometimes the pictorial representations of Nargajuna, he has some serpents over his head, sort of forming a protective shield or something like that. So there's some kind of karma. Most of the karma we create are called movable karma. Some kind of karma we create are immovable. It only ripens one particular realm. And one example of that is the karma that you create by developing the Tibetan word samten or dhyana. In Pali they say jhanas, of the form realm. The first, second, third, and fourth, they call them absorptions because the mind is completely concentrated. And it has temporarily separated from attachment and the delusions of the desire realm. It hasn't abandoned them at all the sense of ceasing the delusions so they'll never come back again. But they are suppressed, so there will not be manifest the delusions of the desire realm in that meditative concentration. So who's a good candidate to be born in the form realm? Who do you know? One of our Dharma friends, Theravada Dharma friends, who comes to Singapore often, teaches in Australia, Theravada monk, Venerable Brahm something, what is it? Achan Brahm. So he's renowned, he teaches his monks and nuns to achieve the jhanas, right? Is it easy to achieve the jhanas? I'm not sure they actually, I have no idea, I'm just taking his word for it. I think he says they do. Generally in the time of the Buddha, the monks had this incredible store of virtuous karma from keeping morality very purely. Right? They kept the vows of a bhikshu, say, their entire life, accumulating constantly virtuous karma, following the word of the Buddha, who was their guru, practicing, you know, all the time. And if they got lazy, they always had older monks or nuns to remind them to practice. And on the basis of that, they were able to achieve these dhyanas. Or that's the dhyanas are the Sanskrit word. In Pali, it's the jhanas. These absorptions. And in so doing, the Buddha, at the time of the Buddha said, this was kind of like the, what can we give an example? Say when you get really tired of something, you need some relaxation. It was their vacation. They relax in the jhanas, because very blissful state, and it would reinvigorate them and help their mind to keep their vows when they arose from that meditation. To be immovable karma, to generate the preparation, even you don't even have to achieve the first dhyana, but even achieving the preparation to that state, certain mind that uses the state of vipassana, what's called mundane vipassana. It's not vipassana that's analyzing emptiness. But this can be achieved much earlier. Analysis of seeing the desire realm as inferior and the form realm as having good qualities. One separates from the mind of the desire realm. Even having the preparation for that jhana, one creates the karma to be reborn there. That's said to be immovable karma that will only ripen in that way. It won't ripen in any other way. Does that mean you will necessarily have to be born in the form realm? Immovable? Next life? Not sure. That's hedging your bets. Shaking the head no, but shrugging the shoulders like, I don't know, I'm not sure. Anyone know? Do you have to be born in the form realm if you create that karma? No? Oh, okay. That was kind of both. So I don't think so. It was a very great amount of karma, but it won't ripen in any other way. It can't be. It can't be utilized in some other way. But there may be some causes. Generally, it's not necessary for the bodhisattvas to be born in the form realm. But some of these four aryas of the Hinayana may be born in the form realm and continue their quest for nirvana there. Generally, the bodhisattvas, they develop these jhanas, the four jhanas of the form realm, or dhyanas, and the four dhyanas of the formless realm, in order to strengthen their mind. They even have certain meditations where they will achieve a certain jhana, or dhyana, sort of this meditative absorption, and then jump to a highest level, and then jump down to a lower level in very quick time. Generally, it takes time to rise from one of those meditative absorptions. Absorption already has a sense of, having reached a certain state of intense concentration, absorbed into something. So it takes some time, generally takes some time to arise from that, and then takes time to enter into another one. But the bodhisattvas practice jumping back and forth so they can enter into one of these states in just a thought instant, to strengthen their mind, their abilities. So there are certain delusions of the desire realm which have analogs in the formless realm. When you're born in the formless realm, you don't necessarily have cities that you walk around and, MRT and things like this. A little more localized, but they are beings who can perceive the lower realms, perceive the minds of people below them, and they can practice the Dharma and so forth, and they have delusions that are of their own realm, certain attachments to form and sensual pleasure and to pleasure of the form realm. Then there's a realm above that, so to speak. And here I don't mean necessarily vertically above, but above in in its subtlety, you know, a finer state that's called the formless realm. And in the formless realm, one doesn't have a gross body. One has, if you really analyze it deeply, even in the Theravada and the Hinayana, not in the Theravada, but the Hinayana teachings in general, it seems like they do recognize there is some kind of subtle form, but much subtler than the form of the form realm. And one has a finer state of mind that is divorced from the afflictions of the form realm. The way that you get born there, sentient beings can be born in the formless realm, as they can be born in the formless realm, as they can be born in the form realm. And also, living beings could create the mental state of the form realm. We say a person who is in one of the jhanas of the form realm, these meditative absorptions, at that point they have a mental state of the form realm. They have a form realm mind at that time. Their mind is separated from attachment to the desire realm. Likewise, a person can develop the meditative absorption of the formless realm, various ways, seeing even the form realm as inferior and thinking, what are the various levels of the formless realm, do you know? Infinite consciousness? Infinite, which was first? Infinite space, thinking, it's nothing but space. You know, just concentrating on that. And as the mind absorbs into that, one can develop a certain kind of jhana or dhyana or meditative absorption of the first of the form of the four formless realms. Then infinite consciousness, thinking, okay, something more than space. There's just consciousness. That has nothing to do with the Chittamatra school necessarily. You know, where you say only mind only, but on the basis of that, one can obtain a slightly more subtle than nothing. There is nothing. Having a meditative absorption like that, although these states are generally not so useful for meditation, because for meditation on emptiness, because the mind is so subtle. At this point, it's difficult to recall and analyze emptiness and so on. No? No, go on. Did I make a mistake? No.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. I unconsciously just...
No, not at all.
Because what I understood was Asita, who predicted that the Buddha will be the Buddha, you know, from as a form of when he was a baby. He was very old, and then he cried. At first, when he saw the Buddha, the baby Buddha, Siddhartha Prince, he was very happy, and then after that, he cried. So the king asked him, why are you so happy, and then you cry at the same time? He said, I'm happy because... Sorry, yes. I'm very sure this Siddhartha Prince will become a Buddha.
Right.
Then I cried because I'm very old now. I won't be able to hear the teachings of the Buddha.
Right.
So he said he will die, and then he will be born in a formless realm, which is just pure consciousness. And when he is born in a formless realm, there's no faculty to communicate even with the Buddha. So he won't be able to understand and listen to the Buddha's teaching. Sorry.
Yeah.
That is my understanding. I consciously just...
Yeah, no, that's good. So is that in opposition or contradiction to what I said? I said generally it's very difficult because the mind is so subtle there to practice the Dharma, to meditate on emptiness. So that goes along with that even that person was saying that they'd have no ability to hear the teachings and so forth. So then the fourth... Peak, peak of cyclic existence. So there, even the person who's developing these meditative absorptions, even abandons these incredibly subtle afflictions of the formless realm just below it, nothing at all, and it is considered to be the highest. Well, we talk one of the path of preparation. The fourth path of preparation was called highest mundane dharma. Do you remember the fourth? But that had the sense of the had a different sense. Here, this is the peak of samsara. Means the delusions that are present in the individual's continuum. They're not escaped from samsara. They're still within cyclic existence, but they have the subtlest delusions still left on their consciousness. So everything else below are temporarily suppressed in that state. And there's some tenet systems, some philosophical systems that say that's nirvana. You know, that's moksha. You know moksha? Another word for nirvana, liberation or freedom. That's my that, you know, like Geshe Zopa jokes about gnosis and noodles. I joke about moksha. It's not mocha, moksha. Because I used to like mocha coffee or ice cream, mm-hmm. Chocolate and coffee. So each of these realms have certain afflictions associated with them that are, say, in the form realm, the afflictions that are there are subtler than the afflictions of the form of the desire realm. And the afflictions of the formless realm are even more subtle than that. So there are different levels of subtlety of afflictions that have to be, in order to escape from cyclic existence, one has to abandon these. So these four kinds of aryas abandon them, and that gives rise to some of the meaning of their names. So the path of seeing that gets rid of the first six portions of the innate obscurations, the innate delusions of the desire realm, those are called enterers into the path, the sotapanna. Let's see here. What is he? I'm looking at a list of from Alex Berzin's site just to have a list here. I have to translate from his terminology. He says, what a Hinayana accustoming pathway mind gets rid of includes the nine grades of the automatically arising form of emotional obscurations associated with minds on the plane of sensory desires. And the nine grades associated with the minds in the two higher levels. Let me see here, get to the right place. So the stream enterers attain a path of seeing with the aim of getting rid of the, what we saw, the intellectually based afflictions on all three planes, on the desire realm, form realm, formless realm, all of the intellectually formed afflictions. That person who enters into meditative absorption on emptiness or selflessness, let's say, Hinayana practitioner, when it becomes an antidote to those intellectually formed afflictions, they become a stream enterer. In fact, they become an Arya being. When does that take place? On the path of seeing or in the last moment of the path of preparation? Do you know this argument? Some Hinayana schools say, on the highest mundane dharma, the path of preparation, one becomes a stream enterer, even an arya. But the Mahayana schools, in general, the Prajnagika says, no, you only become an arya once you have that direct realization of emptiness, not before. You haven't entered into the path until you actually realize emptiness. So that person is called a stream enterer. So there's two portions of that. There's a stream enterer, or entering stream enterer, and then there's someone abiding in the state of being a stream enterer. So the entering into the state of stream enterer is like what's called an uninterrupted path. When you actually have the antidotes to the delusions present. So the delusions, the afflictions, are not present, but they're in the process of being abandoned. They still, some seeds still exist in your mind, but they are not manifest in your mind. The next thought instant in that meditative absorption, you are said to be an abider in the fruit of stream enterer. That's why I said there are 8 divisions of these aryas, right? You've heard that before, right? Enterer into stream enterer, even the word enterer comes twice, and abider in the fruit or the result of stream enterer. Does that sound familiar, Jeffrey? Jeffrey has more Singlish accent than I am. Pure Singlish accent. Oh, wait. He's looking. So that's called stream enterer. So they've gotten rid of all of the intellectually formed delusions of all three realms.
Okay.
Then the person that has becomes a once returner. What's the difference between them? That same person who is a stream enterer may later, when they've meditated on emptiness longer, on the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths, they could become what's called a once returner. What does that mean? They will, some here I think I said it, they will take rebirth only once more in samsara. I think generally it means they'll only take rebirth once more in the desire realm. But anyway, you could say once more in samsara. So once returners have achieved a path of seeing, there's certain levels of afflictions of the desire realm. They said 9 main kinds of afflictions that are abandoned on the path of seeing. And of those, the once returner gets rid of the first 6 of those, of the desire realm. So they have some subtle delusions left of the desire realm. So they may arise from that meditative absorption and spend many years practicing after that, maybe even lifetime after that. But they won't be reborn more than once in the desire realm because their delusions for the desire realm have been reduced. And then once they've entered into the state of being a once returner, the very next instant when those afflictions, those 6 sets of the 9 afflictions are ceased, they are abandoned, one is said to be a enterer into the result of once returner. Because they will attain arhatship after only one more lifetime, and I think means in the desire realm, but maybe in the other realms, they are called once returner. In other words, they will return with another samsaric rebirth only one more time. So that's the sense of once returner. You knew that, right? Did you know that? Yeah. Yes. Sing again. Once more as a human. That's kind of my memory. But here, it in Alex's text, he said, once more in samsara. So I seem to remember, I mean, they only be born once more as a human, because non-returner usually means they won't take rebirth as a human again. We'll get to that next. Yeah. Good. We have an expert now, Jeffrey. You have female counterpart of Jeffrey here, and Cecilia. Oh, Cecilia was also here before. So, and also, what's this gentleman's name? What's your name? Yuching. So we've got male-female experts and male-female experts here I can call on. And then also, what's your name? Ching-Ching and KK. I want to talk to KK later about my modem. So we have lots of experts around, and other experts also. So we've got stream enterer. The sense of stream enterer, I think, is the sense that they've entered into the supramundane path. They've entered into Arya, being Arya beings. They've entered into the stream, and then they abide in the result of that. They may, when they arise from that meditative absorption, they may practice longer, collect more merit, hear more teachings, again and again meditate on emptiness, and at some point when they meditate on the emptiness of the Four Noble Truths, when the right conditions arise as antidotes, they can enter into being a once returner. When they get rid of the first six of the afflictions of the desire realm, and then the next instant they become enterers into the fruit of that. Then the so-called non-returners. What does that mean? They get rid of the last three sets of afflictions of the desire realm, the subtlest ones. So if they're rid of all of the afflictions of the desire realm, why would that mean they wouldn't take rebirth in the desire realm any longer? Because the sense of non-returner is that they won't take rebirth in the desire realm again. Certainly, when I say the desire realm, you can say human general. Why is that? Because they've already abandoned rebirth in the hells, in the lower realms, in the hells, the prey to the animals. When? On the patience level of the path of preparation, remember? The delusions have been ceased. So what's the main thing? Say you have karma to be born in the desire realm. Why the fact that you don't create any more karma, you already have karma, why does that mean you won't be born there? Ah, you know, right? You know the answer? You know the answer? What's your name? Sisi? Isim. Suikim, do you know? I don't even remember what a question. What did I ask? Do you know what I asked? Why? What? Why simply having abandoned the delusions, all say the no more returner, the non-returner, in the sense of that means they will no longer take rebirth in the desire realm as a human, because they've already abandoned rebirth in the lower realms. Why does, if they've abandoned the delusions, why does that mean they can't take rebirth there? Because they still have the karma in their mind stream to be born there. Ah, oh, here's, this is, that's, okay, this also our my number one expert, okay. So generally, when we talk about the 12 links, you've heard of the 12 links of dependent arising, some of you, we sort of intimated a bit. So it gives more detail. At the time of any one person passing away, still as an ordinary being, at the time of death, it sort of determines where you're going to be reborn the next lifetime, because you'll have various karmic seeds on your mind stream to be born. Maybe in the form realm, if you have some immovable karma, if you've developed that jhana, or of some seeds to be born in the hells, the animals, the predators, the humans, and so forth. So it depends on the state of mind at the time of death when we talk about craving, grasping, and becoming. These are all, craving, grasping are delusions. They're actually amongst the afflictions, and they are modifying some karma due to your state of mind to ripen more rapidly than others and to reach the state of just about to be mature, just about to throw you into the next rebirth. Craving, grasping, becoming is the state where that karmic seed has been fully actualized, sort of like at a whole plate of seeds here. I'm not sure. It might be that if you were to, let's say as a worldly example, maybe if you were to put upward through some, say it's on a big screen, so there's some air can come up, so you put up through it certain chemicals that will activate certain of those seeds and not others. Does that make sense? It might be, you know, in a biological, botanical sense, maybe certain nutrients that are going to cause the cardamom plant to grow or the pepper plant to grow or the, you know, whatever. A little bit like that activating mind at the time of death is going to be what causes those seeds to grow. So if you don't have the afflictions at all of the desire realm, because the non-returner in their meditative equipoise have now eliminated the last three of those nine. The once returner got rid of the first six of the nine delusions associated with the desire realm that are to be abandoned by the path of seeing. And then the last three, while the person is becoming a non-returner, when they're entering into the state of non-returner, they've applied the antidotes to that. And then the next moment when those are gone, they are said to be abiding in the fruit of non-returner. And so there is no activating cause for the karmic seeds to be born as a human. There's nothing that will activate them at the time of death. There will only be activations of the more subtle seeds. Does that make sense to you? Did you follow? No, he didn't follow again. So do you understand my analogy of the seeds on a screen? So certain of the seeds, say at first you're putting up nutrients, maybe gaseous nutrients with warm air and moisture and so forth, to ripen all of the seeds. That's generally how we are now. Except we don't have many seeds to be born in the form and formless realm. Most of ours are to be born in the hell, and believe it or not, in the hell and animal and praetor realms. So if you were to eliminate some of those nutrients coming up, the ones to be born in the hell and animals and praetor realms, those seeds would still be there on the screen, but they wouldn't be getting any activation to sprout. So a little like that, on the path of preparation even, one has, the nutrients, and here's maybe this is a good example, the nutrients coming up at that point are so meager to activate the seeds of the desire realm that they'll never come up. Still some nutrients coming. On the path of seeing, no nutrients for the desire realm. No nutrients for the lower realms are coming at all. But even before that, there was some activation, but it was so meager that it was not enough to cause you to be reborn in those states. Now in the path of seeing, you won't be born in the lower states because of not having any kind of activation nutrient. But also as a stream enterer, a once returner, you've eliminated the activation energy, let's say the nutrients to these seeds in this analogy, to the seeds of a certain portion of the desire realm, that only the subtle, only the most hardy of those seeds will be able to throw you back into the desire realm. So we call that a once returner. And then when you become a non-returner, there's no nutrition, no activation for the desire realm seeds at all. Does that make a little more sense? Just by that analogy? Okay, so we get, just so you feel comfortable. So then, when entering into the state of arhatship, you're not yet an arhat, you're entering into arhat. So that a meditative equipoise, and you're now applying the antidotes, because you've abandoned all of the delusions associated, all of the afflictions associated with the desire realm. All that's left are the subtler afflictions of the form and formless realm. And you and both of them have nine sets of afflictions. You abandon all nine sets of the form and formless realm. You are abandoning them on that first meditative equipoise. This would be on the, if you look on of the various five paths, this is on the path of meditation. The end of the path of meditation, the last meditative equipoise, you are applying the antidotes to those, so those delusions are not manifest. Still, the seeds are there during that first phase when you're entering into the state of arhatship. And then when you're abiding in the fruit of arhatship, that means the very next instant when those things are not only suppressed, the seeds are eradicated, almost like the fire of the wisdom has caused them to become impotent. You are an enterer into the fruit of arhat. Okay? So, do you remember that now? Four types of aryas. You could say there are eight types of aryas. What about the bodhisattvas? Are the four aryas applicable to the bodhisattvas also? Ken? Is it, that's like singlies? Can be? Oh, ten. I thought you said Ken. I remember somebody. Somo, you remember Venerable Somo? She was from Singapore. She's been in America for many years, Land of Medicine Buddha. All the time, when I was there, I'd ask her if we could do something. She'd say, Ken. That's very Singlish, isn't it? Ken do that. I thought that's what you were saying. You were saying ten. Ten bhumis. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, no.
So there's some, you mean some of those bodhisattva bhumis are equivalent to?
No, just example, if there's 10 bodhisattva, there's 10 bodhisattva.
Yeah.
But in arhat, there's this.
But can we talk about bodhisattva stream enterers? Bodhisattva once returners, non returners? Ken? who's I heard someone over here say. Again? Arya Bodhisattva, Bodhisattva Superior mean the same thing, right? It's just a translation of the words Arya. Yeah, you can talk about, if you said a stream enterer is someone who's become an Arya, you might impute stream enterer to someone who's achieved the path of seeing, and you might impute enterer into the state of arhat to an eighth bhumi bodhisattva because they've eliminated all of the delusions. But in general, that's not done. There's a famous text in the when one studies this, when one studies the Prajnaparamita called the 60 Sangha, the 60 kind of sangha. So if you divide these four aryas down, there are various kinds of stream enterers, there are various kinds of once returners, various kinds of non-returners. Generally, maybe, I'm not sure if there are more than one type of arhat, but generally, if you go into the fine divisions, there are 60. So that's like, that's what the Geshe's, you know, the Tibetan monks, that like our Ken Rinpoche, Geshe Chuni, having studied all of the philosophical texts, and then they go into the highest philosophical class, where the other people have already graduated, they go into sort of postgraduate, called the Larampa class. They study again Vinaya and Abhidharma, and during their meals and everything, they would always, they would things like, they would ask questions like, what are the 60 sanghas? What about that 160 sangha who was, all sorts of incredible details, you know. This is what they, rather than talking about, did you hear who Brad Pitt is married, going out with? Huh? That's what we, no, that's what we, usually that's our meal conversation or something like that. So when they had their meals, this is what Geshe Jamba Gyatso used to tell me, that the Larampa Geshe, these are the kinds of things they would talk about. So there are more divisions in these four aryas, and in the Hinayana scriptures also, they talk about all these possibilities. Some once returners that might have had the karma to do this or that, and you know. So generally, those names, there's a way of imputing some names, just as you had suggested when you gave those two examples of being Arya and being Arhat to the Bodhisattvas. But in general, they say that's just Ming Dakwa, that's just imputed. They are not generally called that. They don't use those names for the Bodhisattvas. Those names are generally exclusively used for the Shravaka and Pratika Buddha practitioners, Aryas, that are traveling along the path. So the Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas have previously become a person who's qualified to be a religious practitioner by thinking of the future lives. They become a Buddhist when they took refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha from the depth of their heart. You might say they've entered into the Buddhist path, although I've never seen that written, what we were talking about this morning. Then when they develop spontaneous renunciation, effortless renunciation. Spontaneous is kind of like an added attribute. The main thing is it's effortless. Right now we can develop a kind of sense of renunciation with a lot of argumentation in our mind, fending off the parts of our mind that say no, no, no. And we can develop a sense of renunciation with a lot of effort. But then when we rise from that, the renunciation is no longer present in our mind. In the same, it may remain for a little bit. It's not like it immediately disappears. It just goes down a little bit. Same thing with when you develop single point of concentration. You've gone through the stages to develop tranquil abiding, calm abiding. You develop single point of concentration. When you rise from that, your mind is actually, what kind of mind do you have at that time? Do you have a desire realm mind or a form realm mind or a formless realm mind? Do you know? Yeah? When you've developed shamatha, you've developed that single, that calm abiding, and you, the first time you rise from that, what kind of mind do you have? Do you have a desire realm mind? Pardon? Formless? Oh, okay. I never heard that. I heard you have a form realm. It's of the level of the first, it's called preparation to the first form absorption. So you don't have, in that meditation, you actually have separated yourself. You suppress the delusions of the desire realm in that jhana, in that meditative absorption. And even in the preparation to that, you've created the karma to be born there in the future, so there's some virtuous, immovable karma. And your mind now is elevated from being a desire realm mind. It's actually a mind of the form realm. So even rising from that, then coming back into, you know, opening your eyes and smelling your tea and so forth, you may keep that mind for a short time, but it starts to diminish. The way to keep it from diminishing is, again, to go into meditative equipoise. And if you've got the time to do that, you can keep that very close to that state of separation to desire of the desire realm. Maybe that's what the monks did at the time of the Buddha, you know, when their mind, even though they had not become Aryas, they had not abandoned any of the delusions, they could suppress the delusions really, really deeply through developing that first, by developing calm abiding and even attaining the first absorption, even the preparation to the first absorption. All of these delusions are suppressed, but it will diminish itself without constantly being refreshed. So you haven't abandoned those delusions completely, right? So the Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas, they would go through this sequence on the path of preparation and the path of accumulation, path of preparation, honing their understanding emptiness, till they become an Arya being on the path of seeing. And then the various, you could divide all the various levels, we would divide them up in other ways, on the path of seeing and on the path of meditation. Certain delusions are eliminated, but in the time of the Buddha gave this category of talking about the four types of Aryas. Okay, it makes sense? So you get some connection between these different things. They're not contradictory. So the end state of achieving nirvana or arhatship, one has eliminated all of the afflictions that keep you bound within cyclic existence. There is no motivating cause than an uncontrolled cause for you to be born in cyclic existence again. However, and because of that, when one enters into what's called one way of explaining parinirvana. Have you heard that term, parinirvana? So-and-so, he entered into parinirvana. You might think that's just a polite way of saying he died. Or she died. They kicked the bucket. We have all sorts of euphemisms, right? They passed away, so-and-so, they died. So when the mental consciousness, the subtlemost mental consciousness, leaves the body that had previously been there, and one, as an arhat, one has achieved the state of arhatship, when that mind leaves, it remains in single-pointed concentration, it's said, on the ultimate truth, on emptiness. By the force of that, of strong motivation to get out of cyclic existence and using this antidote of meditating on emptiness of the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths again and again, one remains in that state sometime for eons. We talked about this before, right? One remains in that state for eons. A very blissful state of mind, chilled out state of mind, until one's samadhi, because the samadhi is a meditative concentration, right? Samadhi begins to diminish karmically, and one at a certain point is awakened by the omniscient minds, by the Buddhas, and one is informed telepathically that one has not finished one's own aim, let alone the aim of others. Mainly one has worked, as in the Hinayana path, one is mainly working for one's own aim to escape from cyclic existence. Doesn't mean one doesn't have compassion. One even has what the Theravada calls, the Hinayana calls, great compassion for sentient beings, maha karuna, but not the same great compassion of the bodhisattvas. Great compassion for the bodhisattvas means they not only sense the suffering of others, they want to do it themselves. Like a mother or a father seeing their child, the car has fallen on the child who's trying to repair the muffler or something. You've heard stories where the mother, frail mother, picks up the car, you know, using all the adrenaline of her body comes at one time. Have you heard stories like that? Some amazing things. So we, you know, that kind of compassion for others is, from the Mahayana point of view, the Hinayana arhats, the Hinayana practitioners, have great compassion in the sense that they have compassion for all beings and every level of suffering. Maha in that sense also, Maha Karuna, great compassion. But they don't have that impetus to remain within cyclic existence to alleviate the suffering of others. They either have not understood that it's possible, or they've understood it's only possible for the super rare individual, like the occasional Buddhas who come. And so they're content to achieve, when they achieve their nirvana, they've eliminated all of the obscurations, of the afflictions that keep them within cyclic existence. So when they are awakened by the Buddhas and told that they haven't achieved the final aim, they again rise the motivation to take rebirth. So now they're not under the influence of uncontrolled karma. Right now we're under the influence of the karmic winds. Whether we want to take rebirth in one place or another right now, we probably don't have much, you know, even wishing or praying to be born there, our minds don't have necessarily the power to ripen those seeds. Maybe higher bodhisattvas, you know, higher beings, maybe with certain prayers can, but generally we don't have the ability. It's almost like the winds of karma take us to our next rebirth. But here the Hinayana arhats who have already achieved nirvana remained in it for enormous periods of time, eons and eons. When they're awakened, they take rebirth out of their own volition, using a certain portion of some karmic seeds in their mind to take rebirth in cyclic existence, and they practice, they accumulate merit for a long, long period of time, just as the bodhisattvas have to accumulate merit for the general thing that's said is three countless great eons. Have you heard that before? Have you ever heard that expression? Countless great eons? So you might say, countless great eons. What does that mean? It's like they can't count any higher. There's some number. There is a number like that. Do you know what that number is? Do you know what that number is? Countless? What it refers to? Swikam, do you know what it is? Anyone knows mathematical notation? 10 to the 60th is called Dangme, countless. And so like they don't have... They do have names for numbers higher than that in Sanskrit, but generally it's like they stop there because there's no... 10 to the 60th, what does that mean? 10 to the first means 1 followed by 10, right? 10 to the first. So 1 followed by 10, 10. 10 to the 60th means 1 followed by 60 zeros. That's a long... It's probably... When they talk about the number of atoms in the universe and the different things like this, you probably haven't seen a number that they ever talk about, 10 to the 60th. So 10 to the 60th eons, not 10 to the 60th seconds or years, 10 to the 60th eons, the ordinary bodhisattva accumulates merit in order to achieve enlightenment. Okay, they need that kind of karma to do that. That doesn't mean every bodhisattva takes that amount of time. Even regardless of, because it's practice, some bodhisattvas enter into the tantric path, they can achieve enlightenment even in one lifetime or three lifetimes. But regardless of that, even on the bodhisattva path, completely not talking about tantra at all, the very famous bodhisattva in the Prajnaparamita, a whole chapter, always crying bodhisattva. Do you know who I'm talking about? So much devotion to his guru. Because of devotion to his guru, even waiting for his guru to give teachings while the guru is in meditation, even cutting his skin to take his blood to because there was dust outside, you know, in the air, and there was no water to be found. So even taking his own blood to use to keep the dust from going, and various kinds of incredible devotion to his guru, he was able to accelerate and collect the merit of maybe one of those three countless great eons, achieved, you know, the path of seeing very quickly. So there are various ways. It doesn't mean you have to spend three countless great eons in samsara. There's ways to accelerate that even in the bodhisattva path. But generally, that's the amount of time it takes a bodhisattva to achieve enlightenment. So what's the reason? Why does how long does it take to achieve arhatship for the Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas? Eons? Jito? Srikami, do you know? I gotta get Jeffrey now, he's just come back. So Jeffrey, how long does it take the Hinayana practitioner to achieve arhatship? Once they've entered the path, does it take an eon or a countless eon or two countless? Oh, it takes two countless eons. Oh, what do you think? Huh? You're guessing, right? Okay. Sweet Kim, do you know? Cecilia or? But I keep forgetting his name. Mr. Hat. You're Googling it. Okay. That's not fair. Jeffrey, how long does it take arhats to? Oh, you'll achieve it first, then you'll tell me. Okay. Generally, it's said that those who have entered the path can achieve arhatship in one, two, three lives, traditionally, or maximum 16 lives, 1/6. It's like nothing, you know, compared to the bodhisattva's path. You might think, whoa, what are the bodhisattvas? Are they less able? Why after 16 lifetimes, if they haven't achieved it in 16 lifetimes, it's almost like they're still reborn again, and they might even have some instincts to practice, but the strong impetus that started this endeavor seeking liberation from samsara, that strong renunciation, it diminishes. Why? Because that kind of Hinayana renunciation is one that eschews desires, diminishes the importance, you know, finds revulsion and disgust in the desire realm attributes. So it's quite severe kind of practice, if you were to practice it very seriously. And it's said that because you are suppressing desires, that can only be sustained for a certain amount of time. So the arhats, they achieve their goal quite quickly because they're not eliminating all of the obscurations to enlightenment. They're only eliminating the obscurations, the emotional obscurations, the afflictive obscurations to liberation. And they can do that in one, two, three, or even up to 16 lifetimes. But after that, that ability to keep away from desires is hindered very much. So they usually achieve their liberation with a maximum of 16 lifetimes. So sometimes quicker, one, two, three lifetimes. So not two countless great eons. I don't think that anyone could keep that kind of renunciation, Hinayana renunciation, for that long. The bodhisattvas, on the other hand, do have strong renunciation, but they utilize desire, not the same way the tantra utilizes desire, but they utilize desire, you know, accumulating wealth, having family, and so forth, to pursue the path to benefit other sentient beings. So they're not deprived. They don't. Their main thing that they try to subdue is not the attachment that the Hinayana practitioners do. The main thing that the bodhisattvas try to subdue is hostility, anger, and so forth. because the main thing they're trying to cultivate is love and compassion for others. So between the two, attachment, which is being subdued by the practitioners of the Hinayana, and hostility, anger, and so forth, that is being the main thing, and we can talk about the main thing that's being abandoned is self-cherishing thought and other things, but from a certain point of view, the main of the afflictions that you're trying to, you don't utilize as much as is hostility, the bodhisattvas. Between those two, attachment and hostility, in your own mind, when I say hostility, meaning anger and hatred and so forth, which of those two last longer? Well, let me say, first of all, which one is more destructive? Anger, hostility, generally that's said to burn up the negative karma. Not only does it create negative karma, it burns up the virtuous roots that we have, right? So it's said to be the worst of the delusions in that sense. But in terms of durability, attachment lasts much longer. With hostility, anger, although you might feel sometimes it's hard to forgive someone who's hurt you, or you know, you might have anger for someone for so long time, but if you apply the antidotes, you could get rid of that relatively quickly. The example that's given is like, if we're at the restaurant and I spill some salt, some nice pink Himalayan salt, and is that the vogue now? Someone got me some, Yen very kindly gave me some Himalayan, pink Himalayan salt for my diet. So it has more minerals in it, supposedly, besides the sodium chloride. Anyway, so I spilled some salt on the table. Generally, the concierge or the waiter can come with his little brush, or you yourself can brush that off, and the tablecloth can look pristine, right? As opposed, and so that's the analogy to getting rid of anger. It can be kind of destructive, but it can be eliminated relatively easily from the mind. Attachment, on the other hand, is like tipping over the olive oil. Sinks in immediately into that nice white linen tablecloth. I'm not talking about the plastic tablecloths at the hawker stand. I'm talking about the nice linen one at the nice restaurants, right? So what happens then? Is that easy? Can the waiter just come and sweep that off? Generally, no. They try to pat it up with some other napkins, but there's still a big stain there. Why? Because it absorbs into the cloth. So like that, attachment, because the appearance of the object of your attachment is something that is karmically dictated, you know, due to your karma, it looks attractive. And without applying the right antidotes, it's very difficult. It's almost as though the mind sinks into that object. Do you know the expression heartbreak? You know, when you fall in love with someone, and then there's some separation. So like, my heart is broken. It's almost as like, because that object that your mind is sunk into now has been pulled away from you, either from them or your own side or whatever, it's almost like your heart is breaking. So attachment, although not as immediately destructive in any one moment, generally, as anger, because anger not only creates negative karma, as attachment does, but anger destroys virtuous karma. Attachment has the added, the separate feature or fault of being durable, very difficult to extricate from the mind. Anger can be extricated, can be eliminated through antidotes, temporal antidotes, much more easily. And if you have trouble like me with getting rid of anger, you might say, well, if anger has been so hard, and it's supposed to be easy compared to attachment, yeah, I can understand why attachment. You know, in the Theravada tradition, when we talk about the root, the main cause of cyclic existence, what do they posit as the main cause? Yeah, but what's the real word? Trishta, what is that? Thirst. thirst, sort of like thirsting. It's kind of, and we usually translate that in Tibetan, they translate it as a word which is translated in English as craving. But basically, the real meaning of that word is not the usual word for craving or attachment. It's a particular kind that's thirsting for. It's like, Alex Berzin, when he gives a nice analogy, like a rodent that has fallen into the water and is drowning, is flailing around to grasp onto anything, thirsting for life. So at the time of death, our mind grasping, thirsting to have a continuity of life, is grasping into any of these seeds, you know, that might keep a continuity of life. So generally in the Hinayana tradition, that sense of attachment or thirst, extreme attachment, is considered to be the root of samsara. Whereas in the Mahayana, we say, no, that's not, it's only the even the underlying cause for that, that's the root of samsara, the grasping for true existence, grasping at true existence. What does that mean, grasping at true existence? It means something appears to be existing from its own side. It's not like you are grasping at it like the rodent who's trying to keep alive, but you are just acquiescing to that, adhering to that, saying, oh yeah, that's right. It's like you're giving no second thought to it. That's sufficient to be called grasping to true existence. Okay? So the Hinayana Arhat has eliminated all of the obscurations that keep them in samsara. They are awakened at a certain point. They come back, they practice the bodhisattva path. To what end? What else do they have to eliminate? Which kind of obscuration?
Knowledge
obscuration is one way of translating it. You know, Tibetans say shedip. You could say that the obscurations that prevent one from achieving omniscience, from knowing all phenomena. So if you add some extra words to knowing, it doesn't mean knowing, it means knowing all phenomena. According to the Hinayana, when the Buddha was alive, so the Hinayana tenets, they understood the Buddha had higher qualities, something differentiated the Buddha from the other arhats. He was the Buddha, right? And so they gave various qualities of the Buddha. The Buddha knew things distant in time, in the past and in the future, that the arhats with their clairvoyance could not see. The arhats with their clairvoyance, like Mahamoggallana, that had special clairvoyance, could see a certain amount in the past and future. So there are examples at the time of the Buddha. One old man, I think I told you the story, you know this story many times from Geshe Trini, other lamas. One old man came, wanted to become a monk. And Shariputra, maybe it was Shariputra, searched with his clairvoyance, or maybe it was Mahamoggallana, searched with his clairvoyance whether this person had created any karma in the past to become successful. What? Arhats can see for 500 lives. Okay, 500 lifetimes. Maybe some more, it depends. Pratika, Buddha, Arhats, others. Anyway, something like that. Some. He couldn't see anything that this guy had created that would make him successful. You know the story. But then the Buddha appears and, come on, I can see that sometime way, way back, he had been born as a fly, had alighted on a piece of cow dung. Even without his volition, he was eating the cow dung, and the cow dung circumambulated in some water around the stupa. That's one rendition of the story. There may be other variations. And that subtle karma from the side of the object. There was no volition from the fly to circumambulate the stupa, but he had created some karma to be successful as a monk. So the Buddha asks Shariputra to ordain him, and he actually became successful as a monk. So the Buddha could see distant time. The Buddha could see distant places. Like, I think it was also, was it Mahamudgalyana's mother had died. Mahamudgalyana tried to see with his clairvoyance where she was born. He searched out in all these different directions. You know, his clairvoyance went maybe 500, I don't know, 500, not 500 lifetimes, that's talking about time, but five, you know, some distance. And he couldn't see his mother, and he went to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, oh yes, your mother's been born in the northern direction in this universe, and that the Buddha could see beyond where the arhats could see in distance and so forth. So the Buddha was said to have eliminated a certain kind of obscuration to knowing. They didn't use that exact word. Wait, you want to say? Right. If you talk about the 10 paramitas or 10 perfections in the Theravada, you get a different list. So that's a little bit, the terminology has to, you have to really check. There's a list of 10 perfections in the Theravada suttas which don't correspond to the 10 perfections. So that it's being used in a different way. In the same way in the Theravada tradition, in those sutras that the Buddha taught, the suttas in the Theravada, if you look up shunyata in the index to all of the suttas, you won't find it. You'll find shunya referred to, but it's not talking about the emptiness of inherent existence. The Buddha didn't teach the Hinayana arhats explicitly about shunyata that he taught in the sutras that were aimed at the bodhisattvas. And sometimes the Hinayana practitioners were present. Like in the Heart Sutra, it's actually Shariputra is present and asks Avalokiteshvara how they practice the perfection of wisdom, right? So, there's a sense in the Hinayana tradition, in the Abhidharma, that the Buddha had eliminated more obstructions than the Hinayana arhats, the Shravaka and Pratika Buddha arhats, so he could see further distances and know more phenomena and so forth and so on. That's kind of an analog to the term that you were using. What's your name? No, this gentleman. Was it? Vijay. That he was saying the obstructions to knowing, or the obstructions to knowing all phenomena. In other words, the obstructions to omniscience. There's certain kinds of, even when you've eliminated all of the afflictions from the mind, and I gave this example the other day, if you were to take all of these jasmine buds, I'm not sure, they don't have much fragrance now. Maybe it's because I still have some remnant of cold. Are they meant to be fragrant? They're meant to be fragrant, right? Maybe they've sat here for a while, so they've lost their little bit of their fragrance. Let's say they're fresh, very fragrant. If you were to toss them out of this bowl, you might think, oh, so there's not going to be any more fragrance. But if you smell the empty bowl, once the jasmine leaves have been taken out, you'll still have a little bit of that fragrance, right? It's as though the fragrance has embedded itself into the glass, or maybe a wooden bowl that you have put some garlic in. You take out the garlic, and even you wash the bowl. You might have to wash it many times, and even then, because the garlic odor has penetrated, has imprinted itself within the wood. The example I gave before from the West, in the springtime, when people take off their sweaters and their woolen garments that they use during the winter, they'd put in the cabinets, but to keep the moths, the larvae and the moths from eating the wool, which they like to eat, they would put in little balls of, I'm not sure, naphthalene or camphor or other things that the moths and the larvae didn't like to keep them away, right? So when you emptied out your woolens the next winter, when you took out the woolens to use, they'd smell of that. But even you take out the mothballs, they call them, the drawer would smell of that. So that's the example of this. when the delusions are present in the mind, they keep a continuity of themselves by our feeding them, you know, because those delusions arise from certain dormant seeds. Even the delusion is not present in our mind. There are seeds of that delusion, we can say, to use a sort of agricultural, analog. There's seeds of that delusion. Even the sprouts of the delusion are not there. If the seed of the delusion is there, when the right conditions for a seed, such as moisture and light and nutrition and so forth, is present, the seed will sprout, right? Sometimes if you look at a parcel of land, even in the desert, over a long period of time of the summer, and then when the little bit of rain comes in the fall or the winter, something sprout up, even though it looked like there was nothing there. There's some seeds that have some potency. When the right conditions arise, they will arise. Same thing with our delusions. So the manifest delusions and their seeds are in the mind. And when you achieve arhatship, you've eliminated not only the manifest delusions, but the seeds of those delusions. But there is still an imprint, like the garlic, like the jasmine smell, like the naphthalene in the drawer where you keep your woolens. There is some imprint in the mind of those delusions. Those kinds of imprints are put under a general category because they can be removed. Those imprints from the mind can be removed, and those are what are called the obstructions to omniscience or the obstructions to knowing. Shedib. Is that the term you usually use in the classes? Knowledge obscuration, something like that, right? So that's what we're talking about. So the Hinayana arhats, in their period of, you know, remaining in samadhi, great, very blissed out state, those stains are still in their mind. So when they enter, when the Buddhas awaken them and they take rebirth voluntarily, accumulating merit and achieving, so they accumulate merit for a long period of time, maybe eons. And then what do they enter? They've already realized emptiness directly as a Hinayana arhat, right? So they don't have to go through the general, you know, stage of realizing emptiness. They've already realized emptiness. Generally, I think they say they usually enter the Bodhisattva path on the eighth bhumi. Why? Because the eighth, ninth, and tenth bhumis, as we'll see, are the stages of the Bodhisattva path just before they achieve enlightenment, where they start to eliminate the obstructions to omniscience or the knowledge obscurations. So they've eliminated all of the previous ones. Usually the Bodhisattvas on the eighth bhumi are sometimes called Mahayana arhats. Generally, the Buddha is called Mahayana arhat, or is called the Buddha arhat. Like when we give the different names, Tomba Chomden De Dejing Shenpa Da Chomba Yanda Ba Zabe Da Dejing Shenpa Da Chomba. Da Chomba means arhat. The different epithets of the Buddha. We say he is the, you know, Tomba. He is the founder. Tomba Chomden De the Bhagawan, Dejing Shenpa, the Sugata, the one gone to bliss. Da Chomba, the arhat, all of those are epithets of the Buddha. So we say there are Shravaka arhats, there are Pratyeka Buddha arhats, and there's the Buddha arhat that's higher than their arhatship. He's eliminated not only the delusions, but also the obstructions to omniscience. The Bodhisattva arhat hasn't yet necessarily abandoned the knowledge obscurations, but they've eliminated all of the afflictive obscurations that keep them in samsara. So they could be called arhat. Not generally called that, but can be called that. So the Hinayana individual who is awakened enters back into the world volitionally over a long period of time collecting merit, enters into the bodhisattva path, perhaps on the eighth bhumi, eliminates the obstructions to omniscience, and eventually attains Buddhahood. From not all of the philosophical schools believe this. Some of the Hinayana schools believe that once you achieve arhatship, they're different ideas. Some believe that once you attain arhatship, you're gone. You've snuffed out the continuum, like a candle. You take that little, some things in the restaurants they put over the candles, they snuff them out, right? You've seen? Or maybe you put a cup over it, you deprive it of oxygen, snuffs out. So that's their sense of nirvana. They take an etymology of nirvana to mean snuffing out, in the sense that the continuum has ceased. Some of the Hinayana schools, and certainly the Mahayana schools, say, many of the Mahayana schools say that is not the case at all. It's not possible to cease the continuum of consciousness. It will continue. Even you've ceased the delusions, so that consciousness no longer enters into uncontrollable taking of rebirth. It's still, the consciousness still continues. So they take the sense of what is snuffed out as not the continuum, but what is snuffed out is the afflictions. What is ceased, nirvana means that, well, the way that the Tibetans translate nirvana, nyanyan le depa, means passing beyond sorrow, the state of having passed beyond all cyclic existence, the suffering of cyclic existence. So the Hinayana path, they might achieve arhatship quickly, just in a few lifetimes, but they remain in that meditative equipoise for eons. And I don't even know, countless eons, many, many eons. And then they have to enter into the bodhisattva path and accumulate merit again, like the bodhisattvas do for a long period of time. If someone had entered into the bodhisattva path at the same time an individual had entered into the Hinayana path, the Shravaka or Pratika Buddha path, even the very slowest bodhisattva that takes three countless eons in time, they would achieve enlightenment much before the Hinayana arhat. So Lama Yeshe used to give an example of this, that and the reason the Hinayana arhat, Hinayana practitioner, the Shravaka or Pratika Buddha, don't deviate from their path of achieving liberation is because it took a great deal of effort to feel that extreme revulsion for cyclic existence and a desire to free oneself that's done with great effort. It can only be kept up for a certain number of lifetimes. Remember I said, because that kind of depriving yourself of pleasure is not something you can keep up for a long period of time. But that's very, very strong motivation is based on another kind of imprint in the mind that we call self-cherishing attitude, right? Self-cherishing attitude is different than self-grasping. You know what self-grasping means, right? Do you know what self-grasping means, sir? Do you know what self-grasping means? You do? Oh, good. What is self-grasping? Suddenly the smile went away from your face when I asked you what it was. You can't look it up on Google.
No, I'm not.
Okay. No. What is self-grasping?
I guess. I'm very new to.
I know that. That's why I'm asking you, is it see if just so I can. I don't leave anyone behind.
Trying to attain something.
So here's self. Desires, self-grasping a little bit different than that. It's that. To our mind, there is an appearance of our own self, seemingly independent of the body and mind. Something existing there from its own side. Like, what's your name?
Tipi.
So Tipi, you yourself, Tipi, think, I am Tipi. If someone says Tipi, you're a liar, or Tipi, you cheated me or something, there is a sense, it doesn't necessarily associate, your sense of TP doesn't associate with your body. If they say you're a thief, it doesn't necessarily associate with your body. It's as though they've accosted you, a sense of you that's somehow really there, a sense of self or atma or soul. The belief in that soul, just accepting that soul as existing, so acquiescing to it, adhering to it as true, is what's called self-grasping. So that particular, and from a Buddhist perspective, that self does not exist the way that it appears. In the same way that the reflection of myself in a mirror that I might mistake, oh, there's another monk over there wearing the same clothes that I look at, I see it's just a reflection of myself. There was not another person there, right? It was actually empty of being a person, but the cursory examination, it looked like another person. Do you follow what I'm saying? Like the reflection in a mirror, or the reflection in a lake. Sometimes the moon reflects in a lake and the deer come and they think that it's almost as though they're mesmerized, as though there's a moon in the lake somewhere. Most of us would recognize that is empty of being a real moon. It's a reflection of the moon. Looks like the moon. Yeah, go on.
From what you are saying, your explanation, but why you use the word grasping? From what I perceive you as saying is without self, maybe. But then, why this element of, why use the word grasping when that is not what you want?
Right.
You know, because, it's like contradictory, actually.
Yeah, because actually it's not there, but we believe it's there. That belief and that going along with, you know, like the reflection or the echo as being really something that's there, that's the sense of, this dependent word is zinpa, grasping, to hold on, to adhere to. In the sense of, even in the least level of just acquiescing. Do you know what acquiesce means? To just go along with something, not necessarily enthusiastically, not, you know, just, yeah, that's okay. I'll go along, I'll acquiesce. You know, like you believe that self is there, even though it's not there. Like you said, you can understand it's not there in a certain sense, but it appears to be there, and because of continual familiarization since beginningless time, we've always believed this, the I and other phenomena, to exist findably. That particular kind of ignorance is called self-grasping. That, even if you were to eliminate that, which the Hinayana arhats do, they eliminate that self-grasping, even along the line when they're achieving that, the self-grasping is becoming less and less. That's the main thing. That's the root of all the other delusions, all the other afflictions. The root of anger, attachment, is this belief and grasping to a self-identity that you have to defend or you have to try to find pleasures for. It's not so much you're trying to find pleasure for the body, but you're trying to find pleasure for the self. You know, good foods, you know, sensual, you know, hearing sweet words and so forth. So there is an imprint of that also that is not necessarily categorized amongst the knowledge obscurations that's called self-cherishing attitude. And that's what prevents the beginning at the Shravakas and the Pratika Buddhas from entering into the Mahayana path. It's sort of like, okay, I could help these other people, other sentient beings, but yeah, number one. Do you use that expression here? That was popular in America some years ago. I have to think about number one. Number one is what? Me, right? I think the Japanese, when they talk about I, they point to their nose for some reason, I heard. Is that true? Anyone Japanese here? Or no? Japanese culture, when they talk about I, is that true? Or are you just scratching your head? So that self-cherishing attitude exists in the Hinayana Arhat, the Shravaka or Pratika Buddha Arhat. That's why they remain in that meditative equipoise for a long period of time, not being able to help sentient beings. So Lama Yeshe used to give the example, like being at a pool party, cocktail party. I don't know if you have them here, or maybe a country club party. Nicest country club in Singapore. You're having a great time, and you're having all sorts of pleasures. You're seeing beautiful people, you're having great food, there's an inexhaustible supply of durian. You know, all of the things that you could enjoy. Maybe even a little bit inebriated. You've had a little bit of wine or something else. And then you get a phone call. Someone brings you the phone and says, it's your mom. And you, mom, what is going on? Mom says, oh, the house is on fire. I'm trapped. Please come and help me. And Lama Yeshe said to the example, this example is like the person who has strong self-cherishing would say, later. So it doesn't mean that he doesn't feel compassion for mom, mother sentient beings, but the self-cherishing attitude is one that doesn't want to deviate from one's own experience of this, you know, the bliss of liberation. Wanting to find the bliss of liberation, having understood the shortcomings of all the pleasures of cyclic existence, wanting to achieve that for oneself, so one becomes inured and becomes calloused to the concerns of others. One still has compassion for them, but one is not necessarily going to give up one's own pursuit of nirvana for them. That's the self-cherishing thought. So that's why the Hinayana Arhat has to enter back into samsara. Oh, finally, no. Enter back into samsara. I was waiting for the right moment to put the lozenge in my mouth. I said, that Arhat enters back into samsara. To basically now, they have to eradicate this self-cherishing attitude that has permeated their mind for all these eons. So it takes a long, long time to do that. So the combined time of, you know, the achievement of arhatship took relatively short amount of time, 1, 2, 3, 16 lifetimes. But then they remained in that meditative equipoise for really long number of eons, maybe more than it takes to accumulate the merit to achieve enlightenment, more than 3 countless great eons. When they're awakened, they again have to enter taking rebirth, accumulate merit for a long, long period of time, eliminating the self-cherishing thought first so they can enter the bodhisattva path, because they still have that self-cherishing thought which doesn't allow them to enter into the bodhisattva path at all, first of all, right? They still have to get rid of that self-cherishing thought. Then when they enter into the path, they've already realized emptiness, but they now have to eliminate the obstructions to omniscience on the last 3 bhumis. They usually enter into the path on the 8th bhumi. It's sort of like it's like sometimes if you've done advanced placement, you have courses here called advanced placement in high school. In America, so in high school you can take calculus, even though that's a college course, if you're like, you know, you've done all the other courses. And then when you get to college, you have the certificate that allows you to skip over calculus or certain courses, English, basic English course, so you can become almost like a second-year student already. A little bit like that, the Hinayana Arhat, when they enter into the Mahayana path, they kind of skip over the first 7 bhumis. They enter in as an 8th bhumi bodhisattva, and they have to spend another countless great eon eliminating the obstructions to omniscience that the bodhisattvas have to do also on the 8th, 9th, and 10th bhumis. Okay, is that kind of clear? So you might... Yes. Say again, this arhat. Right. To enter the Mahayana, they they have to generate bodhicitta. Generally, when a bodhisattva enters the bodhisattva path, and when they generate bodhicitta, they enter in the path of accumulation, right? The first of the five paths. The Hinayana arhat, they have to also generate bodhicitta, but as soon as they generate bodhicitta, they find themselves on the eighth bhumi, because kind of like they have advanced placement. They've already realized emptiness directly. They've eliminated all of the afflictive obscurations from the mind. So they don't have to progress through those paths, you know, to generate better and better understanding of emptiness, to eliminate the obscurations. But they have to finish the last three bhumis, which sounds like not much, but it takes one countless great of the three countless great eons that a bodhisattva takes. I think, if I remember correctly, you guys are pretty good on this, I think they spend one countless great eon on the path of accumulation. Then from the path of accumulation to the seventh bhumi, another countless great eon. Looks like a lot to be done then. And then on the eighth, ninth, and tenth bhumi is another countless great eon. So the Hinayana arhats have to spend at least that amount of time on the eighth, ninth, and tenth bhumis. So I mentioned in the other classes, doesn't seem to be something that you talk about here, maybe because Singapore is such a small area. American lore, when you go out walking in the wilderness, if you know that there's a river that splits, at a certain point the river divides, it's said to be better to cross the river once, you know, before it divides, because if you go to the other direction and you have to cross it twice, the two tributaries or something like that, more difficult. So like that, it's said that the person who thinks about it, thinks about the defects of first achieving nirvana, waiting in that state for a long period of time, like the person at the cocktail party or the country club party, you know, so absorbed into their self bliss, their self-cherishing attitude, that they can even give up considering to work for the welfare of others who have been our mother, like mother's calling, I'm burning in samsara. Later. The Lama Yeshe is very skillful talking about that. So knowing if you achieve nirvana, you remain in that, it's like the, can you see? It's like, here's the river before it's split. Here's the river after the tributaries have split. So if you cross here, you first achieve nirvana. You have to remain in that for a long period of time. Then you cross over that by entering back into samsara, practicing the bodhisattva deeds, accumulating merit, and eliminating the obstructions to omniscience, and you achieve enlightenment. Whereas if you'd cross the river once as a bodhisattva, you were all this time you were able to help, as a Buddha, you're able to help sentient beings. So it's much more skillful if you have that strength of mind, if you've been exposed, and all of you have been exposed to the Mahayana, you can feel very fortunate. Wow, I'm very fortunate to have heard this and have it pounded into my head. Again, this is the most expeditious path to take, the bodhisattva path. Even though it might seem daunting at first, you know, oh, why go through all that effort working for sentient beings? I'm just going to achieve nirvana. Eventually, you're going to have to do this later. And all the time that you have wasted in that blissful samadhi of nirvana, sentient beings have been suffering. And you've kind of ignored them because of that. Okay. Yes, please.
All the main disciples of Buddha, Sariputra, Ananda, Moggallana, all these are arahats. Why at times Buddha, Sakyamuni didn't teach them Mahayana part? Most of the times, most of the main disciples are
become arahat, just Christians.
Right. So when we read the, so certainly if we read the Theravada suttas, or so we say sutras, the suttas, the various discourses of the Buddha, the main people that are being talked to, when the Buddha taught the first turning of the wheel, one of the classes we talked about what that meant, mainly meant the discourses starting with the when he taught the Four Noble Truths to the first five disciples in Sarnath. You know, after he achieved enlightenment, 7 weeks he waited, sought out these five disciples that had been the sons of the ministers, and one of them had been the youngest minister, that had been his disciples for the 6 years of ascetic practice when he had sought out all the various teachers who were very close to them. They had given up on him. He went to Sarnath to teach them. That particular discourse, mainly teaching about the Four Noble Truths, was mainly talking about the Hinayana path. And all of the subsequent teachings that he taught in that same vein, you know, that same stream of thought to achieve nirvana, all of those are called, even though they were a distant time, many years later, they were all called teachings of the first turning of the wheel. When the Buddha taught the Bodhisattvas as his special audience, when he taught the Prajnaparamita Sutras, which is only found in the Mahayana, you don't find the Prajnaparamita Sutras in the Tripitaka of the Theravada, you do hear mention, there were Hinayana arhats there. Shariputra was there, Buddhanyana was there, Asvajit, you know, one of the first five disciples. Many of them were there, kind of just like say for instance, before you receive, if you ever have a chance to attend the Kala Chakra initiation of the Dalai Lama, have you ever, you know, you've heard of it? So say you say, I'm not ready for Tantra, that's beyond me, I don't know about that, but you want to be there. Dalai Lama is giving the discourse. So you come and you're kind of curious, but you know you're not quite ready. It's a little bit, I think a little bit like that. The Hinayana practitioners, whether they were arhats or not yet, they were on the Shravaka path, most of them. And again, I said there are probably no Pratyeka Buddhas there because the Pratyeka Buddhas don't generally hang around when the Buddhas are teaching. They're not, they want to do this by themselves. Most of them were Shravakas. But it, my sense of it is that like they were there and they really appreciated that and they marveled at that and they even asked questions about that. You know, Shariputra asks Avalokiteshvara in the Heart Sutra, hey, because Shariputra is considered to be the foremost of the Shravakas in wisdom. He was considered, you know, the go-to guy. Do you say that? The go-to guy, you know, like is it KK is a go-to guy for computers at ABC, right? Or, you know, Jeffrey is a go-to guy for, you know, certain pujas, and what was it, Dachom, Venerable Dachom, formerly Major Fred, is a go-to guy, used to be the go-to guy for animal liberation, something like that. So Shariputra was the foremost in wisdom. Of the Hinayana practitioners, mainly talking about the wisdom that the Buddha taught in the first turning of the wheel, how to achieve nirvana. So he's asking Avalokiteshvara, hey, how did the bodhisattvas practice their perfection of wisdom? Because he didn't know. It's something beyond his knowledge of wisdom. So in the Hinayana scriptures, you don't generally hear mention of bodhisattvas. They might have been there also, but maybe the Hinayana doesn't make, I don't know. They might have, out of their, you know, they want to be also hear all of the teachings. They might have been able to hear those with their clairvoyance. I don't know. But you generally don't hear about the bodhisattvas at the Hinayana scriptures, right? Theravada suttas. Maybe occasionally the Maitreya or one of the other bodhisattvas is mentioned, but generally not. But in the Mahayana sutras, you do hear mention of the Hinayana disciples being there. But I think it's mainly in that sense of like us going to the Dalai Lama's Kala Chakra when we're not yet ready. We appreciate that. We might aspire to that, but we're not, that's not our practice right now. So the Hinayana arhats ask questions. One of the other famous examples is when the Buddha was teaching this one sutra called the Sutra of the Three Heaps. Do you know that sutra? Cecilia, do you know that sutra? You know for sure, because it's the sutra within which the so-called Bodhisattva confession. And so, sometimes the confession of the 35 Buddhas is called the Sutra of the Three Heaps, but actually the Sutra of the Three Heaps is longer. It's just in the middle of that. There, when, what is it? Upali, I think. Upali was the barber. When certain of the, in Kapilavastu, certain of the royal court, once the Buddha became so renowned, these other guys wanted to go, oh, he's one of us, we're going to, you know, superficially they become renounced. They go off to become, along with it was Ananda and who is the naughty one? Devadatta. You know, it was a cousin of the Buddha. All of these royal caste people were coming to join, asked to become monks. And as they're going, Upali, who was the barber, low caste, not royal, even below royal caste, just the barber, he wanted to come along. And when they got to these royals, they got to the stupa where the Buddha had cut his hair. You know, on his to and sent back with his attendant, his robes and everything. They wanted to emulate that. They cut their hair and they gave their robes to Upali, who had accompanied them as their servant. And they said, "Bring these back to the palace. Tell them that we left." And he said, No, I can't do that, because if I go back, they see me from the distance. They'll think I killed you, and they won't wait. They'll just kill me." And they said, "Oh, okay, you can come with us." So he accompanied them to the Buddha. The Buddha ordained them. You know who he ordained first, right? Upali, right? You know this story? You know this story? Is it part of your common lore? No? You haven't heard this? So, according to ordination, there's always a seniority according to when you were ordained. He or she who is ordained earlier has seniority over the others, so that the others have to, if there's food being offered, they have to offer to the senior monk or nun first, then the next in ordination. When I was in Tibet many years ago, and the Panchen Lama was giving some teachings, that we had, it was the first time in decades the Panchen Lama had been allowed to teach. And a huge number of people came to Shigetse, and I happened to be there, and there was, after the teaching, there was going to be the monthly, bi-monthly sojong, the monks and nuns' confession for the pratimoksha vows. So in that, there was this old Tibetan monk who asked me in Tibetan, he said, "When were you ordained?" And I said, "This and this year." And he said, "Oh, you're a senior to me." Is that sense, so you sit first in line, you know, according to seniority. So Upali, the barber, who the other people had wanted to ignore, he was the one that was ordained first, and he became foremost. Remember, Shariputra was foremost in wisdom, Mahamoggallana was foremost in what? Magical powers, who was foremost in ascetic activities. Upali was the foremost in morality. So when this three-heap sutra is given, Upali is one of the interrogators. He's a Hinayana arhat. He's there, foremost in morality, and he's asking Manjushri, I think, or Buddha, maybe both appear, how did the bodhisattvas confess their moral downfalls? You know, I know how to confess the downfalls of the pratimoksha, but how did the bodhisattvas confess their when they break the bodhisattva vows? And that's when the Buddha explained about the Sutra of the Three Heaps, which is the essence of it, is the thing that we call the confession to the 35 Buddhas, or a little more precise is confession of bodhisattva downfalls. Jiangshu Senpei Shakba Tungwa. So there are many examples like that when the Hinayana arhats were present at the Mahayana Sutras, but they, and they emulated, they admired that, they inquired about that, but they still, because of the self-cherishing thought, they still continued on their path, okay? So we've exhausted our time, I think, right? It's 3:30. We exhausted the delusions. I wish we could say we've exhausted our afflictions, our delusions. So let's just, with that in mind, keeping in mind next week, we can go into some more of the details. And if you have thoughts or questions, write them down. Or you have something you wanted to ask right now? Okay, one question last. Last question. Oh, good, good. You've got it written down even. Okay.
You mentioned that the arahats will enter the Mahayana path on the ikrang, right?
They enter into the Mahayana path.
When they develop the uncontrived bodhicitta, then they enter in the ikrang.
Yeah, they enter, when they develop bodhicitta, they enter into the bodhisattva path, but they don't enter, at that point, they're not called a path of accumulation bodhisattva. They're actually an eighth level bodhisattva, if that's what you mean.
Yeah, I don't agree with that.
You wouldn't agree with that. Good. Okay.
No, because then there will be no reason for one to enter the.
Say again. I couldn't catch.
You know, if that's the case, then there is no reason for one to be a definite Mahayana lineage, right?
I think you said something about definite in the Mahayana lineage. So just you know what he's talking about. So there's different things. To be definite in the Mahayana lineage means right from the beginning you have karmic instincts to persevere in the Mahayana. Okay?
Okay, and the harakat have to enter in the path of accumulation is because they have not enough merits. They have not accumulated enough merits. Because of first one path of preparation to the seventh ground, you need two great cognizance yon. So arahat, maybe they, as you said, they may be arahat 16 lifetime. So they have not enough merit. So they have to enter the
Generally, to reach the seventh ground takes two countless great rounds on the bodhisattva path. But the arahat has accumulated merit to achieve the equivalent of that. They have eliminated all of the obscurations, all of the afflictive obscurations. And in order to develop bodhicitta, they have to. It's not as though as soon as they arise from their samadhi and they take rebirth that they have bodhicitta. It takes them a long time to accumulate the merit to achieve bodhicitta. So they're accumulating merit then. They've already realized emptiness. So it's said that they enter, when they entered into the Mahayana path, they enter in on the eighth bhumi. But this is good. Good point. You understand what you're saying? You're saying, hey, this doesn't seem fair. The bodhisattvas take two countless great eons, and these bodhisattvas lazily sitting there, it seems like they should be penalized or something, right?
That's right. So they have to be entered for the path of accumulation to accumulate the two great countless eons.
Okay, we'll make note of that objection to the... Yeah.
That time when I asked the same question, why is it that the Buddha gave the Theravada teachings? So
why did the Buddha give it? Just put your hand around it, open up where you speak.
Because most of the Buddhas, during the Buddha's time, most of his disciples attained arahantship. And somebody asked one of his disciples, I can't remember which disciple, asked the Buddha, said, but Buddha, you look so radiant and so different from us. Did you practice the same path that you are teaching us, the Theravada tradition? Mm-hmm. The Buddha says, no. I practice the Bodhisattva path. That's why I am a Sakya, fully enlightened Buddha. Right. But what I am teaching you is the Arahant path, but it is the shortest and the fastest. During this time, I am the Buddha. Now that you are my disciple, in this lifetime, you can gain enlightenment.
Exactly. It's very short. 1, 2, 3, 16 lifetimes. Very quick.
During the Buddha's time,
immediate during that lifetime if they practice according to the Buddha. So the reason why the Buddha teaches the Theravada tradition is because it's the shortest and it's the fastest. So for Bodhisattva, it's different because it takes a long time for Bodhisattvas to practice before they can gain enlightenment as a Buddha, fully enlightened Buddha. And also with regard to, because you were mentioning about the Arahants being in Samadhi, right? From what I read from the bibliography of Arahantaman, he used to...
Arahant who?
Arahantaman. Who? Achanman. The Thai meditation arahant.
Oh, someone who's recognized as being an arahant, sort of contemporary to us sometimes.
Yes, contemporary arahant. Okay. So in his bibliography, he wrote that he used to, in his meditation state, he realized that for the past many lifetimes, he practiced the Bodhisattva path. But using his insightful meditation, he realized that for him, it's difficult to attain the Bodhisattva path. So he decided to let go, and he decided to become an Arahant in this lifetime. So he practiced and gained enlightenment. But because
he didn't gain the enlightenment of a Buddha. He gained arhatship, right?
Arahatship.
Which sometimes is called enlightenment of the arhat, yeah.
But in his book, he says that during his meditation, once he achieved arahant, he can quantum entanglement with the Buddhas, the previous Buddhas, and all the arahants. Because if he has any question with regard to the Dhamma, he enters into the meditation state, and the Buddhas, the previous Buddhas, and the arahants will come and answer and give teachings to arahant.
Interesting. That's possible, because sometimes in the Theravada teachings, it doesn't teach explicitly about emptiness. But if you realize that when you achieve these higher states in the Theravada path, you may be able to see the Buddhas and receive teachings, more sophisticated teachings about emptiness. But let's leave it, because it's going over a little bit long. I get your point, but... From the Bodhisattva point of view, on the path of accumulation, what is it? I think on the first path of accumulation has how many parts? Four? Three?
Three.
Yeah, small, medium, and large, right. It's three parts. So I think on the, what is it, on the medium? No more questions. No more questions. I think on the medium path, I'm happy to stay afterwards if you want to ask questions. But I'm just thinking that some people have buses and things to catch, and they told people they'd be home at a certain time, so we don't want to go over too much. So at a certain point there, I think it's on the path of accumulation, isn't it, that a bodhisattva becomes irreversible. So their bodhicitta can no longer be lost, and they will no longer enter into the Hinayana path. So this particular gentleman who is renowned as being a Thai arhat. Bhante, what? Okay. This individual, if he said that he had realized, he had meditated in many previous lives on the Bodhisattva path, he had not yet achieved the state of irreversibility on the Bodhisattva path. Famous example is Shariputra. Shariputra, at a certain point in previous lives, is said to have practiced the Bodhisattva path. Have you heard this? Have you yourself heard this, ma'am? No. So at that point, at a certain point, he had not yet reached the point where his bodhicitta was gold-like, because gold is usually immutable. You change the shape, it still stays gold. Right? So I think second or third, someone knows on which level of the path of accumulation. So at one point he is one of the mischievous devas, sort of Mara, appears to him, knowing that he wants to achieve the Bodhisattva path, but is going to try to put some obstacle, and says, "Please, I need your right hand. I need a right hand to make offerings, please." And Shariputra is thinking, all these lifetimes I've never given my body for others. So with great effort, because he not yet reached the point where he feels no pain to give the body at the beginning. In fact, it's considered to be inappropriate to give one's body at this point in the path, because you feel pain and so forth. So he cuts off his right hand. And what can he, how can he offer it? He has to offer it with his left hand, right? And this Mara says, how dare you offering me with your left hand? Why is that? Because they use the left hand to clean off their underside after they go to the toilet. You never offer, in India, it was considered a great disrespect to offer something with the left hand. In the world today, we don't. Maybe even you clean your backside with your right hand. More, see, if you're right-handed, who knows? You know. But you usually wash afterwards and soap and everything like that. So at that point, Shariputra's mind, they say it's Sempamba, so it's like was completely depressed and thinking, oh, how can I work for sentient beings if they're like this? And at that point, his bodhicitta was lost. And he entered into the Theravada path, the Hinayana path. This is many, Theravada is only one of many, many Hinayana paths. It's a little bit erroneous to say Theravada, but that's what generally what the only Hinayana path that we know today. Mahasanghika and some other versions exist, some lineages of Vinaya exist in various places, Korea and other places, but generally that's the Hinayana path we know. So there are examples of that. So this particular arhat that you're mentioning, the Thai arhat, may have been, had not yet reached that state of irreversibility. So that's not contradictory to the teachings, but fits in quite well. It's interesting. So let's just do a dedication of our energy that we created this morning, this afternoon. We've definitely, with good intention, analyzed the teachings, heard them, come up with, you know, discerning questions, incredibly, you know, clear that you're listening and thinking about the teachings. You've created a vast store of merit. Try to dedicate this because you know that the merit will ripen. This is because we have not yet realized emptiness, most of us or any of us. So it's contaminated virtue which will arise generally within cyclic existence as some kind of pleasure, which is contaminated pleasure, not real, you know, uncontaminated pleasure, yet still we can dedicate that merit so that it has a link to uncontaminated phenomena such as, you know, the realization of emptiness and the achievement of Buddhahood and so forth by thinking in ways like this. In whatever way this merit ripens, may become the cause of my cooperative condition of my continued Dharma practice. You know, so if I become wealthy, may I not be, you know, arrogant and miserly with it, but because of these dedications, may I be impelled to use it for the benefit of the Dharma, my own Dharma practice, the Dharma practice of others. If I'm born very attractive due to the practice of morality, rather than it become a cause of pride and you know arrogance toward others because I'm so attractive, may I use it to attract others to the Dharma, like the so-called dakas and dakinis, you know, utilizing their energy to attract others to practice the Dharma. Whatever way these merits ripen, may they become the cause of my continued Dharma practice, this life, future lives, up until the achievement of enlightenment. May this karma not be exhausted. May it become a cooperative cause of my achieving the state of Buddhahood where I can effortlessly and spontaneously work perfectly in whatever way it takes to lead sentient beings out of samsara in the most efficacious, most quick and effective manner. Thank you very much. So those of you who are interested, they're still continuing on Tuesdays and Thursdays talks on Lorig. You can catch up if you want to listen to those and haven't. on awareness and knowing. And next Saturday, we'll continue another set of talks on the four close placements of mindfulness. And next Sunday, we'll continue more nitty-gritty on the Mahayana paths and grounds. Thank you for your attention and your graciousness and your good questions. All of you are very alert. I'm very impressed with the Singaporean students. Thank you so much.